is kind of an unusual story, but our very first client was Tony Robbins, and let's be honest, like, you couldn't have a better first client.
Tony Robbins as your first client?
Hi, it's Tony Robbins. Listen, I want to give a shout out to Amber Mack or anyone who's considering reading her book, listening to her speak, or having the opportunity to work with her as a consultant.
How long were you his client for, and what were some of the things that you learned from having your first client?
That is a really great question, because I don't think I've ever been asked that before. But
welcome to Hustle for Everything podcast. This is the podcast where we receive stories, tips, and tactics from entrepreneurs who have done it. Today, we have a Canadian legend in the building. We're here speaking to Amber Mack, CEO and president of Amber Mack Media. Amber, how are you?
I am doing great. So great to be on your show and chat with you guys, and looking forward to a fun 2024.
Most definitely. So to jump right in, you know, we have a question that is consistent throughout our podcast, which is, how were you raised? What was your brought up see?
I was raised in rural Prince Edward Island, so Canada's smallest province, and my parents were entrepreneurs, and that has truly had an impact on everything that I do, because I grew up at a very young age with parents who were always running their own business, so all I saw was them working together, growing their business, definitely a team, and I really liked that idea of doing something a little bit untraditional. So I grew up in a place where I was able to get exposed to lots of entrepreneurs, and within my home, really just seeing my parents have this interesting model where they worked together their entire careers, and now I run a business with my husband. So in many ways, I've kind of fallen in their footsteps.
Most definitely. So it must be like off the beaten path to go into journalism from living in PEI, like you said, the smallest province in Ontario. So what was that like mindset like as a kid? Were you always into journalism and tech at that time? Like, what was the difference?
I have always been a really curious person, even at a very young age, and it might have been out of boredom, because when you do grow up in a rural area, I think so often you're kind of forced into making your own fun, and you often have to have a big imagination. There's not always a lot going on. So I was always very curious. And then one of the things that always interested me at a really young age is interviewing people and watching journalists on TV and listening to them on radio. And I really liked this idea of building a career through talking to people and hearing stories and telling stories that maybe not many people had heard before. And so at a really young age, I was drawn to journalism, to the point where even in high school, I wrote for our local paper. And I kind of knew that I wanted to be a journalist. What I probably didn't know is that over the past couple of decades, journalism has certainly changed a lot. And so when I left the newsroom full time many years ago, I did so because I kind of foresaw some of those changes, but I never anticipated where we'd be at today in 2024.
Yeah, most definitely. So we were on TV, you know, talking about tech during that time. When did it dawn on you that, all right, this is no longer going to be the notion of, you know, the current landscape of media? Because you were early to the game. You were in like the media space independently almost 16 years ago. Right? Like, walk us through your mindset then.
Well, I was working in a newsroom at City TV in Toronto, and I was their web specialist, which was a new title. And it was a very interesting time, because I think in the newsroom, people certainly recognized the importance of the internet, but they weren't really sure how it was going to play out in our lives. I had an opportunity, because I had lived in San Francisco very early in my career, to kind of get a sense of how technology was going to impact us. And so I brought what I knew about that to the newsroom. While I was there, I definitely was not necessarily kind of one of their star reporters. I was more pushed off to the side, and I sat in a little corner with some of the other geeks, if I can call them that, who were producing content for both TV and the web. And I think through my months there, I started to realize, along with my husband, who was a cameraman there, that we could actually produce content ourselves. And it didn't have to be within the structure of a newsroom. And of course, way back during that time, and that was in the in 2007, that was also the same time that the iPhone was released and people were starting to do citizen journalism. And so I think it really was a tipping point in terms of the opportunities that existed creating content, not within the walls of a large media organization, but actually starting a business as a content creator, or what many people will call influencers today, on our own. And so it's been a great journey seeing that through. And thankfully, it has worked out for us.
Yeah, no, most definitely. All right. One thing that is glaring in my mind is transitioning that early, right? 16 years ago, I think that's like 2007, 2008, around then, 50 Cent's hot with In Da Club. You're transitioning into independent journalism and thinking to yourself, how am I going to build a business out of this, right? What were some of the first deals that you made that really made you think, all right, this is going to be sustainable?
That is a really great question, because I don't think I've ever been asked that before. But there certainly was a point where we recognized that we had an opportunity in front of us. And so at the time, I was contacted by Tony Robbins' team. You're probably familiar with Tony Robbins. He is a business coach, a motivational speaker. He runs massively successful conferences. And so someone on his team contacted me while I was working as a tech reporter at City TV. And I thought, okay, well, he's coming to Toronto. Obviously, he wants us to do a story on him. But actually, it was a little bit more than that. His team wanted advice on how to create content and further build Tony's presence in the social media space. So they wanted to reach out to consult with someone who understood the social media space and the possibilities that did exist there. And so it is kind of an unusual story, but our very first client was Tony Robbins. And let's be honest, like, you couldn't have a better first client out of the gate than someone who is such a big character like Tony Robbins, who was super, super helpful in terms of writing a testimonial for my first book that I wrote, which was shortly after I left the newsroom. And it was really just as though all of our stars kind of aligned at that time.
Yo, that is insane. Tony Robbins as your first client? That's probably one of the biggest flexes. I saw that. That was one of my questions I had, because I saw one of your oldest YouTube videos is the Tony Robbins testimonial, where he gives like a glowing review.
Hi, it's Tony Robbins. Listen, I want to give it a shout out to Amber Mack, or anyone who's considering reading her book, listening to her speak, or having the opportunity to work with her as a consultant. When I first met Amber, I was blown away by the level of passion she has for the internet, how it can connect people from all over the world. But passion is wonderful, but adding to it a level of expertise and competence and a commitment to serving people that I've seen rarely in people around the world. And I've had the privilege of working with quite a few people the last 30 years.
So I was really curious about how that came about. So how long were you his client for, and what were some of the things that you learned from having your first client?
Well, we worked with him for just over a year. And at the time, he was, again, really trying to sort of suss out the possibilities that existed online. And I do want to say, for people who are familiar with him but maybe don't know a lot about him, he's always been an early adopter when it comes to technology. And even now, with many of the events that he hosts and produces, he has a massive studio and team where he's doing virtual events that are just at a whole other level. So he's always been early in terms of recognizing opportunities. So after working with him for more than a year, I think one of the things that we realized is that, okay, you know what, if we have someone like Tony Robbins coming to us to get advice about how to grow a business in this space, we know this is the space where we should be investing our time and our energy. And shortly thereafter, we did a deal with Microsoft Xbox, and then the list of tech clients continued from there. But it really was just amazing to get a window into how he ran his business. And quite frankly, I don't know anyone, even to this day, who works harder. I remember being at events with him, and I thought, you know, okay, well, the day is done. We've been up since 6 in the morning. Surely I can go to bed at like 8 or 9 o'clock. And then people would tell me, no, 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 we have another meeting at 11 p.m. And it's just a constant grind around the clock. And so, first of all, it showed me just the level of excellence you get with some people. You know, it's not like they're overnight successes. They put in the hard work, and he was a great example of that and still is. And also, I think at the same time, really showed me that there was no way that I could keep up with that pace for much more than a year.
Most definitely. Yeah, I saw his documentary, and it looked like he was doing some insane things. All right, now, it's incredible that you got deals from Microsoft, from Xbox, from all these tech companies early. So do you think that that could be redone if you, or you could execute that again if you start from scratch today? Or do you think that you'd have a harder time trying to grow a brand in today's time?
I think that one of the most important things when you are building a business is to do something that no one else is able to do. And we recognized that, I think, fairly early on in the business. So one of the things I've certainly put a lot of effort into thinking about is sort of like, what makes our business unique at Amber Mac Media? And I would say your team understands this completely. Not everybody does. But you want to be able to kind of own different channels. And what I mean by that is Amber Mac Media, we do production, right? We have a studio here in Toronto where we do live streaming, live TV, media tours, the list goes on. So we do production. We also do distribution because I have maybe overall 500,000 followers on social media. So we have that distribution channel. And then thirdly, we have talent. I front a lot of the work that we do. So one of the unique things in the content space that we've seen over the years with our clients is they really do like coming and doing business with us because we are able to do the production, do the distribution, fulfill the talent piece, and have the studio. So typically, as you know, sometimes they would have to outsource, you know, one, two, or, you know, maybe even three of those things. But with us, they're getting that all in-house. That means we're able to be really hugely competitive in terms of our pricing because we do all of that in-house, and that has allowed us to really set ourselves apart from other organizations, not just way back when, but I would argue still today.
You know, Hustle for Everything has been working for a minute. You know, this has been under wraps for a long time, but we're finally doing our first live podcast.
Let's go!
Congrats.
So we're doing a live podcast in collaboration with Indochino.
Oh,
and at the Indochino, yeah, bro. At the Indochino showroom.
Okay.
You know, March 24th, the Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah, we're having live panels with Mark LaFleur. I don't know if you heard of Mark LaFleur. Mm-mm. Bro, he sold his company True Local for 16 M's.
Jesus.
I'll sell whatever I need to sell for
16 M's. You know what I'm saying? Take my arm, bro.
Word. Then you have Ryan Hinkson from Eat Famous.
Okay.
You know, food expert, City Line, you know what I'm saying? Quit nice. His job at Coca-Cola to become a full-time entrepreneur, full-time creator.
Wow.
And he gives his game on that. It's going to be at the panel.
Holy.
Then we have a wonder kid, bro.
Another hard hitter, bro?
Bro, this kid.
It's going crazy.
Man, I don't know if she's... All right, I'm going
to... Don't play with us, bro. Don't play with us. Come on,
man. So this is wonder kid. Okay. His name is Zach. Mm-hmm. Bro, he sold a company at 18.
Yeah.
For $1 million.
Jeez. Wow.
Jesus, how old is Zach now?
21. Damn. And he was just on Dragon's Den and closed a deal with West Hall. And now he has a hockey business selling hockey sticks.
Jeez,
you know what I'm saying?
Man.
And that business is valued at $6 million. You know?
Jeez.
And holy.
And he's going to be there. You know what I'm saying?
Hard hit, bro. Congratulations.
Word. That's huge. Word.
So it's going to be a good one, so they're going to be dropping all their gems. And Mark's flying in, actually. So
my bad.
Yeah. He moved to Texas.
Off the PJ.
We're not the PJ.
Yeah, the PJ, yeah.
No.
We're
going to
send over there.
I wish. But, yeah, man, he's flying in just for the event, so I'm, like, super excited to have him on.
Yeah.
You know, and we're going to have, like, our wine sponsor, Narai, there, so you can come and get some wine. It's going to be...
Man, you guys are killing it, man.
It's going to be a dope vibe, bro.
That's elite.
You
I know? Love it.
Congrats.
Appreciate that, bro. Nice. Appreciate that, most definitely. So let me ask y'all, with all that mentioned, mm-hmm. how much do you think it costs for the
I was about to ask you myself. You know me.
I'm
not going to hesitate. I'm like, Christ match. $60 per head.
$60 is what you're...
That was my guess.
Wait, what's the question? In terms of
how much do you think the price is for a ticket to get
for a ticket? Oh,
I'm saying 60, but I feel like you're gonna hit me with the surprise promo that it's free. $99.
I feel like honestly, it's worth much more than 60. But I feel like working with someone to be like 60, but this guy is, you know, a wizard, so he's gonna
what's the number?
60 to 70, I'd say.
65, 70?
Yeah.
All right, so the price is 30, bro.
Okay.
Jesus.
You know that's what I'm hard. Saying?
Man, give me the 50% off. Okay.
Yeah, okay.
30 for all that, bro.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Where's it going to be at?
It's going to be at the Indochino Showroom.
Yeah.
Nice. 134 King Street West.
I love it.
No, March 24th.
I'm going to try and pop out.
Yeah, yeah, the link's going to be in your bio, all the stuff. Like,
all that link's going to be in my bio. Okay. You know, I'm the hustler, everything, 247 Hustler.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, man. That's it. That's interesting. Taking it all in house, so they don't have to go. It's like a one stop shop for their marketing. Okay. When you first started, and comparing to now, what was the pie chart of your revenue streams that you were building?
Yeah. So also a really great question. So the business piece of it, in terms of Amber Mac Media and working with clients to create content, has traditionally been around 50% of that pie chart. Very early on, I also started as a professional speaker with a speakers bureau, so that was the other 50% of that pie chart. And so what I would do through those professional speaking events is often get clients for Amber Mac Media. So it was, you know, definitely a nice sales cycle in terms of going out, speaking at conferences about how to grow your business on digital, and then those people who were interested would become clients of Amber Mac Media. And so it allowed us to have these two revenue streams, right? Both the speaking and the content business. And what's really nice about that, quite frankly, is that when the speaking's really hot, when I'm super busy out there at events, maybe the content business isn't as busy, but that's okay. And of course, the inverse is also true. So I like this idea of not just having one revenue stream. I like this idea of being able to do multiple things. And listen, you talk to lots of entrepreneurs, so I know you know this, but I think that's true for any entrepreneur in 2024. Like, the days of thinking that you can only do one thing, I mean, that's just a total fallacy.
Yeah, most definitely. Like, having multiple revenue streams is the absolute key to it. And that's something that we're getting into, you know, whether it be keynote speaking, events. That's one of the next things that we're building at Hustle Over Everything as well. So I'm very curious, you know, one thing I want to do is get your opinion on current tech situations and on the tech trends. So first things first, NVIDIA. You know, NVIDIA right now is being valued at a market cap similar to the economy of Canada, which is absolutely insane. What are your thoughts on that and NVIDIA's skyrocketing growth?
Well, I think for people who don't know a lot about NVIDIA, they are, of course, in very simple terms, a chip maker, probably best known in terms of their capabilities within the gaming sector. And naturally, artificial intelligence and the explosion of artificial intelligence has made them even more popular in terms of the needs for even more computing power. So I think NVIDIA is a company that is in the right place at the right time in history as far as the explosion around AI that we're seeing right now. And I think it's also kind of fascinating because I think over the past few months, we assumed in the tech sector that the big stories would continue to be around the open AIs or what's Microsoft doing. And I'm not saying NVIDIA came out of left field, because certainly those of us in the tech sector have always been aware of their success. But for a lot of people, they're probably surprised they're hearing more and more about NVIDIA and just the size and value of the company. So it speaks volumes about this AI gold rush, so to speak, that we're in right now, and the importance of companies that are actually making the hardware and the technology to make all of this AI stuff work.
Yeah, most definitely. I think it's also the concept of leverage, right? Because they're in this position where they produce a predominant amount of chips, it allows them to have the perceived leverage to make their valuation go astronomically high, right? Do you feel like they're overvalued?
Well, I think they probably are overvalued a little bit. I'm not immune to tech companies being overvalued. I lived in San Francisco during the 1990s. So in the late 1990s, there were plenty of tech companies that were overvalued. And unfortunately, historically, we've always seen this bubble kind of pop in the tech sector. And I think we'll see that, particularly probably with AI software companies over the coming years, where where the valuation is huge, but then there's lots of other players who start to participate and compete. I would also say, you know, the CEO of OpenAI, of course, the makers of ChatGPT, Sam Altman said something recently that you probably saw where he talked about the fact that the next billion-dollar company could be a one-person company. Who knows if that's going to be true? But we certainly are living in very different times in terms of the potential for business success, and maybe even the necessity for massive companies is no longer the case anymore.
Yeah, most definitely. Now, I'm curious, you piqued my interest. What was it like living in San Francisco in the 90s, especially as someone in tech?
Well, I was really young when I lived out there in the late 1990s. So I worked at a company called Razorfish, which was a big web design company at the time, one of the most popular. And I was coming from Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island into the Bay Area, and I was just blown away at the startup scene in San Francisco. Anyone at that time who had any skills in the digital space could land a job anywhere they wanted. That was just a truth at the time. And when I went to work at San Francisco at Razorfish, I also saw both the dot-com boom and the bust happen within months. And so the companies that I was exposed to during that time that were just like hugely overvalued, some of them within months were entirely gone and had lost all of their investment money. And that was kind of the norm out there. So it taught me a lot of things. One is, you know, be careful how you use borrowed money. I think that's a good lesson for all of us. And then I think two is there was a lot of vaporware at the time. You know, that there was a lot of technology that the founders couldn't really explain. They had no actual real use case scenarios or success. And I was always, I think, since that time, I've always been very skeptical of the hype around some of the tech that we see in our lives. And so it was a really good learning experience at a young age, and it didn't require any of my own money, so that was good too.
This podcast is brought to you by Narai Cellars Wine, one of the only black owned wine companies in Canada. So not only are you supporting the show, but you're supporting black ownership. Now, who is Narai Cellars Wine? They have 10 years of experience in winemaking. So what we're going to do is going to hit the link below and visit naraicellars.ca and try the wine for yourself. Let's get back into the show. I'm curious. You know, you do a lot of interviews and you're continuously interviewing people on keynotes. What has been the top interview that stands out to you? You know, what are some of the interviews that you think are some of your gold mine memories in your career?
I think there's probably a couple, but just to stick with the theme around content, probably the most interesting interview that I did was with Reed Hastings from Netflix. I got a chance in Toronto to sit down with him a few years ago and talk to him about that journey, because to me, if you think about the Netflix story, it is really quite incredible. This is a company that many years ago was actually physically mailing DVDs to people's homes, and then you would have to mail the DVDs back to Netflix. So that was kind of their business model. It was very different than what they're doing today. And so I've always loved the Netflix stories because, for all intents and purposes, they should have failed, right? Like, that was not the best business model. It certainly did not have any long-lasting power. But what they recognized is the growth of the internet and how people were watching content, particularly on platforms like YouTube, for example. So interviewing Reed Hastings was really eye-opening to me, because in our conversation, one of the things that I saw with him is that he was basically responsible for driving Netflix in a direction. Not that he sort of forecasted out of the blue, but out of necessity in terms of what he wanted in the future. He wanted to be able to, you know, watch content in an easy, accessible way. And so I always love these stories of companies that have been built because the founder saw and experienced a problem and immediately witnessed kind of a good opportunity. And I think there's no better example of that than Reed Hastings and Netflix.
Gosh, you know, that makes a lot of sense, because the impulse to pivot and pivot correctly is a remarkable one. Like, there's only a few people who've really done that successfully. You know, I would say like him and Mark Zuckerberg have been the only people to really pivot, not only, but people that have pivoted in a successful way to create monumental businesses, you know, like acquiring Instagram, for example. A lot of people didn't understand what that was at the time, but now like the valuation of that is insane, right? Okay, so yeah, moving
you're,
on.
You're exactly right. I mean,
Go ahead.
You're exactly right. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about the Netflix story, too, is that, you know, many of us make little pivots in our businesses every year, right? I certainly have done that in our business where you're kind of, you know, you adapt and you shift and you change things. But what's really amazing about the Netflix story is, like, that was not a small pivot. Like, going from the physicality of a mail to order kind of business to a streaming company that was then also producing its own content. I mean, that's a real pivot. So that story to me is a really good one for people who are looking to draw inspiration in terms of a company that has entirely shifted the way that they're doing things and with huge success.
No, I agree. And you know, speaking of pivot, you know, one thing you mentioned in a previous interview was that you vacation in Charlotte in Florida, right? But yeah, you actually don't take vacations, right?
Yeah.
And I feel like that was kind of on purpose, right? Because you kind of pivoted into your independent journey so you could have that control of how you make your life, you know? What were some of the intentional decisions you've made to really sculpt out the life you want versus like being stuck in the corporate 9-to-5?
You know, there's a famous saying out there that I did not coin, but it certainly has stuck with me, is only an entrepreneur works 80 hours so they don't have to work 40. And I've always liked that saying because one of the things I love about being an entrepreneur is that I have the freedom to decide when I work, where I work, how I work. Those things are all really important to me. And yes, you know, if you actually added up the hours, I'm probably working more hours than the average person who goes to an office every day, but I get to do it on my own terms. And that has always been really important to me in terms of designing my life. And then secondly, I think day to day, I've never really gone to work or done work where I felt like, ugh, I just don't want to do this today. I cannot remember that ever really happening to me. And that is something that I have designed in my life. So I feel like, you know, it's kind of the best of both worlds, this idea of being able to build your own business, but also do it around a topic that you're truly passionate about and truly interested in. I basically have built a business around learning how the future works. You know, that's kind of a dream, I think, for me, that I've been able to achieve.
Nah, that's beautiful. So now, where do you see the future going in terms of content specifically?
Well, I think the future of content is really interesting, and my heart goes out to all of the journalists I know right now who day to day, I'm getting more emails and messages from people who have worked in newsrooms for, you know, decades, who are being impacted by all of the layoffs, as well as the disruption in the media space. At the same time, I would say that that disruption in the media space is not something that was unexpected, if you know what I mean. I mean, I think most of us who work in content creation understand that, hey, there's a lot you can do today thanks to technology with a lot less than you used to need to do it. And so that means that in some ways, some of the newsrooms, the people running them have been a little bit irresponsible in terms of the way that they haven't adapted to this new world that we live in. And I think it's at the heart of that is the fact that many people are losing their jobs in the process. Newsrooms are not a place that you necessarily go to see a lot of innovation around content. There are some exceptions, but generally speaking, I think that's the rule. So I think in terms of the future of content, I think it's going to be these smaller decentralized teams who are going to be creating content in the future. We certainly have the technology today, whether it's cameras or you know, streaming technology, AI, whatever it might be, to allow us to do a lot more with less. And so I think smaller decentralized teams will, for the most part, be kind of the future of content. At the same time, there needs to be more done on the journalism side in terms of investment in news, because it's so important in terms of our democracy. But I think we're going to see a real shakeout in the coming years in terms of what the future newsroom actually looks like. And it's going to look very different from when I joined way back when.
What do you see it looking like? It's like, one thing I see personally is a lot of the AI taking full, like, avatars being like the main stage factor, but I'm curious to see what you would think.
Well, I think you're just going to see teams that are a lot smaller. I think that you're going to see even the sales teams who are selling content have to kind of think differently about the content that they're selling. I don't think you're going to see sort of centralized places the way we have historically. Like, okay, well, I'm producing content and it's a TV show that, you know, is a 1 hour long TV show or a 30-minute long newscast. I think everybody's going to have to start thinking about contents where it's so decentralized that it may just end up on different platforms. There may not be one place where everybody enjoys it, but you're going to have to think in a very sort of decentralized way. And I also think in terms of the future of newsrooms, right now when you walk into a newsroom, typically it doesn't feel that different than it did even decades ago. But I think you're going to see people who are in that newsroom, they're not just going to have kind of like one job. You're not just going to be a producer or an anchor. That's already been starting over the past few years, but you're going to have multiple skills, right? You're going to have to be able to do a lot of the roles that were once roles that were dedicated to one person. So a big shift in that space.
Yeah, and that's something that I think you probably mastered, especially when it comes to sales too. I'm curious, like, as someone that's pitching, closing deals, have you delegated that, or is that something that you're consistently doing in sales calls, talking to brands, talking to brand managers and marketers? As a one person business, are you consistently doing those things, or are you mostly focused on just producing as talent and making sure the quality of the content is bright?
Well, a few years ago, we hired a full-time salesperson at AmberMac Media. So that has been, hugely advantageous, and a big shout out to Jessica on our team, who is our account director. So I had been doing, like you said, all of the sales. So I had been building relationships with brands. I had been pitching our services. But a few years ago, when Jess became part of our team, it has been a real game changer. So she is a full-time employee of AmberMac Media. She sells our services. And that includes, you know, me as talent, and our services in our studio as well. And that has allowed us to kind of level up in a different way. So our team is small now, you know, we're just a few employees, but there was a time where we didn't even have that type of bandwidth, but now we're able to, again, have people focus on their different parts of the business. And that's been really great, I think, for the company, but also for me, because so often as an entrepreneur, you end up doing everything. And I certainly can do a lot of those different parts, but it frees me up to be able to do more now that we have a small team in place.
Nice. So how big is the team now, like, in terms of numbers?
We're small, so under 5 people and another 5 contractors. So still subcontractors. We're still small, but we have definitely moved from that kind of solopreneur phase, if we can call it that, to be able to grow the team a bit, so that we have someone who is helping us specifically just with podcast production, someone who is helping us specifically with digital strategy. We have a full-time salesperson. Chris is in charge of all of the production. We have someone who oversees all of our contract negotiations, someone who helps with all of the accounting services. So all of those people are different people within the company. And that means, like, for me personally, I get to be out there doing more of what I love, which is creating content, speaking, hosting events, whatever that might be. And I'm freed up from some of those other tasks that we've been able to bring people on to do.
That's like the next stage for a lot of us entrepreneurs. I feel like a lot of us are in that solopreneur phase. I would love to get more insight into leaving that stage, you know, because I feel like a lot of our audience is in that messy middle where they're doing all of the things, they're in the meetings, and doing social media content consistently and trying to figure out how I can really delegate this properly. What was your process like? Did you go the route of hiring contractors first and bring them to full-time employees? I would love to know like your strategy, because some people have different strategies for this.
Well, I'm actually, I think, pretty conservative in terms of bringing people on board and growth. I mean, I definitely would be more careful about bringing people on full time. That's why we're still really small. We do work with a lot of subcontractors. But I think, you know, one of the things that, at least in the past few years, that we've really started to do is to sort of recognize when we work with someone who could be a great team member, having the experience first, working with them before we make that offer to bring them on board as part of the team. And so that to me, I think, is really important versus just hiring someone and making them a full-time team member without ever working with them. I think for a lot of solopreneurs, that's not really a good move and maybe too quick. So subcontractors can be a really great way to kind of transition someone into a full-time role. And I would also say that a lot of the solopreneurs who I've spoken with over the years in terms of interviews were kind of hesitant to hire people or outsource some of the things that they do. But I think it's really, really important, if you can make it work, to start to outsource some of the pieces of your day, because otherwise you can't really focus on growing the business in a meaningful way. And that is because you're tied up with a lot of these administrative tasks or the sales tasks, and then you're not out there, you know, maybe doing the thing that you're really good at, that no one else can do. So I think find the place where you're most valuable in the business, and then find other people who can fill in those gaps. And it doesn't have to be full-time employees. It could be subcontractors. But it is only that way that you can kind of inch towards growth. We saw this during the pandemic, because we already had a small team in place when the pandemic hit, and we were extremely busy during the pandemic with virtual events and brand partnerships, because we had already built up our team and the studio to be able to produce content, you know, in an efficient way with some of the biggest companies in the world. So again, I think having a team is so critical if you can get to that stage.
No, most definitely. Building a team up can be very challenging too. Hiring, and especially for me, because one of the things I do a lot, I have a lot of contractors, so we've managed about two teams of contractors, so I have found it quite challenging. And then managing that and working with brands on top of managing a team, I feel like is where delegation becomes a necessity, right? And with working with these top brands, you know, how has that been in terms of managing your time effectively and continuously having brand deals? You know, do you find yourself more so having one-off brand deals or sponsorships, or do you see yourself having longer-term sponsorships? What's your strategy there?
Well, we're really fortunate because we have a lot of repeat business from the brands that we work with, so that is amazing. I think, I know this is not feasible for every solopreneur in the content creation space, but I think it's obvious to outsource sort of production pieces, right? Like, oh, I need help with production, like camera or podcast production, whatever that might be. But the one person that you don't think about bringing on board, which we were able to bring on board full time, is a salesperson. And it is a game changer within a business to have someone who does client services and does sales, and that's their full-time job, because that is a full-time job, right? And talent, if you're out there in front of the camera and you're supposed to be the one who's always fronting the content, it's harder for you to be accessible to clients all the time, to be answering their emails, to be project managing. That kind of erodes at that other piece of what you're trying to do. So I see a lot of content companies that focus on growing with production resources, which I think is important. But then that missing link is kind of the sales piece. And when you have someone in charge of sales, I mean, you know, they have to actually grow your clientele. They have sales numbers. You can see their success right away. You know, that is a role that is very measurable. So it is possible to bring someone in and to have certain goals and thresholds they need to meet. And you know, if it doesn't work out with that person, then find someone else. But the sales piece is something so many of us, so much of that we usually do as solopreneurs, that not that you don't have to do that role anymore, but it really helps to have someone on board who can be your partner in that. And that's really how I see Jess, is like, yes, I attend the first pitch in terms of that meeting. Sometimes I can't be there, but Jess is doing the day-to-day and building the relationships, so that frees me up to do other things. So the sales piece of it is, to me, that investment is what has really helped to grow our business.
That's a big gem right there, because I think that what a lot of other creators will do is they'll have an agency that'll be taking care of sales, or they'll hire someone to do sales, but it's more so the top level where it's having the introductories. But in terms of client services, that usually falls back on the creator.
Yes.
So they have all of that on themselves, right? Yeah. But having
all over you in terms of that point, but you make a really great point. Like, I work with lots of agencies. You know, we partner with lots of agencies, but at the end of the day, we also do lots of brand deals direct with the brands themselves. And so I think there's huge upside in that financially, in terms of not always having an agency in the middle of the relationship, or having the opportunity to work direct, or being able to negotiate, on behalf of your company, having a salesperson who can kind of front those negotiations. It becomes, that person is kind of the engine to the business in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most definitely, like a big part of the engine, as well as like the delegation aspect of it. Because like, from all the creators I usually work with, when they get a brand deal, they're working directly with them, so they get taxed, so they cannot create as efficiently because they're dealing with the client services aspect of it, right? Whereas having that person that's both a salesperson and a client services person, they get to be that blocker for that. Whereas an agency, they'll still be that blocker, but you're losing so much more money because that budget is being divvied out between you and 12 other creators. So I think that's a really good point that you bring up when it comes to hiring. It's not just hiring an account director in terms of getting the sale, but in terms of client services as well.
Exactly.
Now, I really think that's something we should be thinking about. What other gaps do you think our creators are missing when it comes to it? Because you have a tenure here. Like, talk to us about that, and then we can start work towards wrapping up on those points.
I don't know specifically what type of content, say, your audience would be creating, but I do know that in the space where I play in our business, it's really B2B content. And, B2B influencers, it doesn't seem like such a sexy place to be, like doing LinkedIn deals. But I will say that there is a massive opportunity in that space right now in terms of people who fit within the business category, specifically around content, everything from sort of cybersecurity to AI strategy, small business productivity. I mean, the list of potential clients goes on and on and on. So that's a space that we have always played in. To some extent, we still do consumer tech as well, but we're much more into the B2B space. So that's the first thing I'll mention, is kind of find those holes that exist out there, those opportunities, and maybe don't think so narrowly about like what it means to be a content creator or influencer. Because it could be much broader than you imagine it to be. That's one of the things that has really helped us in our business. And then I would say, secondly, is that, listen, like, just because everybody's doing a platform like, you know, TikTok or whatever the platform might be, maybe it's for you, it's like you don't want to be on LinkedIn. Don't be there. Like, don't be in the places that you don't really want to be. You don't have to be. Nobody's saying you need to be there. Like, I don't even do anything on TikTok, which is probably really weird because there's lots of opportunities there. But hey, I'm kind of a B2B influencer, so like my bread and butter is LinkedIn. And so, you know, I wouldn't do what everybody else is doing. I would try to kind of position your content in a place where no one is playing right now. So, you know, that I think is something that gives you that advantage over other people, because it's a very crowded space sometimes, and you want to be able to stand out a little bit.
Got you. Find the arbitrage in space online. I like it. Awesome. As we're towards wrapping up, you know, for the creator, and this is the creative entrepreneur that is working in their silo by themselves, you know, trying to build their business up, what advice do you have for them? You know, as you were in that space when you first started before Tony Robbins, what advice do you have for them?
I think there's really two things. One is find a problem, like a content problem that actually exists. So what is our content problem? Well, technology is moving too quickly for people to understand how it works. So we're demystifying technology all the time to be able to fill that void. So find a content problem and fill that hole. If the hole's already full with lots of content, maybe you find another hole. So that would be my first bit of advice, like find the problem that exists in content, fill the hole. Secondly, you know, in terms of not just the problem piece, but the passion piece, find something that is as authentic to you as possible, like something that only you can do or gives you an edge. Still today, although I've been in this space for a long time, there's not that many women talking about technology and building content in this space. So that's a space that I can kind of live in where there's not a lot of competition. If you find yourself in a space where there's a lot of competition, hey, by all means, like maybe you want to stay there and keep doing what you're doing, but it's going to be a lot harder, right? And so I think, you know, find something you're passionate about that's unique to you, and then find that content problem that you're able to solve. If you put those two things together, I think all of a sudden you have the potential to exist in a space that is attractive to brands, to eyeballs, to people, because it makes you different, makes things interesting, and you've really set yourself apart.
Big gems. Now, to close out the episode, we have our deal or no deal, our audience question. All right, let's jump into it. You ready, Amber?
Set.
All right, cool. So this is from John. All right. Dear Alex, thank you for all that you do. I appreciate you. Now, one thing that I struggle with is being in this golden handcuff of content creation. I finally found an audience that wants to hear my content, but I dislike my content. I don't like what I'm doing, and it's frustrating. I finally found something that's monetizable, that's making money, but it feels redundant, repetitive, and I'm downright sick of it. But I find myself tied to it because I'm only getting money from this audience. What do you think I should do? Should I stay in it or leave? Deal or no deal? What are your thoughts?
I think deal. Like, stay in it, but start something else on the side. Until that other thing gets bigger, don't drop that source of revenue right now, but maybe you're able to minimize it over time and then do the other thing that you would prefer to do. And maybe, just maybe, they can be complementary, right? Maybe you don't love what you're doing, but maybe you could start something else on the side while you're doing that thing that is complementary, and they can build off each other. So for me, that would be, hey, like, keynote speaking is a lot of work, it's a lot of stress, but I know it's going to bring in clients on the other side. So find that other thing, but don't let go of your revenue stream. It's super important to have financial stability, and that's why I would say deal, stick with it.
Most definitely. I completely agree. Stick with it, you know, and figure out why you started that in the first place. You know, if you feel like you're changing, then, you know, work towards the new thing, like Amber says, and continue to do that thing as the main source of income. Create a side hustle, if you will, 100%. You know, most definitely. With that being said, ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up the episode. Also, what you can't control. So control your grind and control your life. I'm Alex.
And I'm Amber Mack.
That's the show, y'all. Peace.